members of her family. As human beings are, temptation always occurs, and she decided to be tempted to stay. Why she would want to stay in Middle America instead of sunny Southern California? She loves the area, having been from Switzerland. I'm sure she will appreciate the temperatures here. And it's nothing like having friends and relatives. She'll be here hopefully this afternoon. I would like to mention that perhaps at some time those of you who do know a little more of the Jauch family might like to inquire where she will be staying and be able to visit her from time to time in a local rest home here, which will be near the family members. It's one that is both owned and run by some of the members. There will always be proper rules in any such home in terms of normal visiting hours or what is expected. We have tried on occasion to take some of the elderly people to lunch. Our smorgasbords are not as satisfactory, I assume, as you have here. We have other sorts. But it is a nice opportunity on occasion, and we have had her over for lunch at our home from time to time. Well, that means two times, I guess. Well, not very often, but when we can, and I would certainly say that these things are very helpful to elderly people who need an opportunity to see others. Otherwise, they tend to be a little more alone. Very often, of course, families are able directly to take care of them, but sometimes it's wiser with the necessary care to have special supervision. We had the privilege of being in Paducah last Sabbath, where Mr. and Mrs. Victor Kubik are. My wife and I have known Victor Kubik for some time, and I performed their wedding. He is a young man who accompanied my wife and me in 1967 to the Soviet Union at the time of the great October Revolution 50th anniversary. As a result of meeting the gentleman who presented the sermonette to you this morning, who with his wife has also visited the Soviet Union, they and Mr. and Mrs. Boyce, and we thought it would be an opportunity to combine our experiences in our slides, and sometime this evening, on the basis yet to be announced, we will have a presentation of our trips to the Soviet Union. And I think it will be a fine opportunity to meet Mr. and Mrs. Kubik if you have not done so before. And we will have things, excuse me, to say that you might not normally expect. The Durians have visited about 9 to 10 years later at their last trip than we did. They have been in areas of the Soviet Union and met kinds of officials whom we did not meet. And they are, of course, not aware of some of our experiences in 8 of the 15 major republics. So I think, and I don't believe the Boyces have ever seen the slides either. If any of you already have, by chance, you're more than welcome, of course, to see the slides that the others have taken that we have not. So Mr. Herbert Armstrong's state of health is probably best called stable. It would be premature at this time to ask about plans, to ask about recovery. We have to be realistic. When one is 85 and one has pushed himself, as Mr. Herbert Armstrong has, often while others rest or sleep on the plane, he sits at a typewriter. It is not as likely that one will survive forever in the flesh, pushing at that rate. Mr. Armstrong has, in fact, been unaware, and he should have been more aware. He was told that sometimes older people, I'll be candid, if he were here, I'd tell him the same thing. He really didn't pay enough attention to the fact that older people cannot work at the same pace that younger people can. Now, some of you know that. You have started to shut down early. But, well, that's a warning not to unnecessarily. Mr. Armstrong had spent some time in Romania under geriatric care, which means care for the elderly. The Romanians, and that doesn't mean hospitalization, that means the kind of supervision to find out what your state of health is and to put you on a regimen. And he needed to cut down in his weight, and the Romanians were shocked how easy it was for him to fast or do without food. And they told him he was doing it too rapidly, but as far as he's concerned, that doesn't matter. He's used to that. For others, it might be dangerous. So he had a weight problem, and he also had a stress factor by the nature of the kind of pressure he puts himself under. He would get up, and immediately he'd be dealing with problems in his mind, you know, in the morning, something that needed to be solved for the day. The recommendation is to keep calm, to walk as much as possible, to get the kind of exercise that is befitting one's state of health. But I don't think Mr. Armstrong was as aware of his responsibility this way, that it's better to cut down from maybe 80% of normal efficiency to 70, 60, maybe 50. Because if you don't do that, you go from 80 to zero. And that's in fact what he did. He was not feeling well in Japan, decided to go on to Hong Kong, was not feeling well there, decided to go on to Israel instead of coming back, felt better in Israel, and made the mistake of not going to Romania, where he should have, in fact, had a rest, and probably his present state would not have come on him at all. But if you know anything about the man, this is what he would have done anyway, and after feeling better, he decided to go to West Africa, where he really got an unusual bug of some sort. That, you know, gave him a certain limitation to resist the flu that was at that time going around in Southern California, and he comes down with that, so he has to go to Arizona, and now he has to rest. And it is doubtful at this point that he will recover beyond 30% efficiency, because I think he waited too long to cut down, and now his nature, his body, has cut him down. I'm trying to be realistic about it, and to be plain about it. Mr. Ted Armstrong has been plain to us. Even when he's in his own home, Mr. Armstrong tells the nurse that he, you know, he's in charge of this home. He can decide to get out of bed when he wants to, and they tell him to stay in bed. And on one occasion, he did get out, and he fell back, and there must have been a clot, small clot, passing through the heart. And if the nurse hadn't given him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, he would have been dead. Let that be a warning to some of you who are elderly and who pushed yourselves. There is a time to be sensible about what you're doing. And Mrs. Yauch is not here this morning. She was exhausted from the trip, not on the day of arrival Friday, not on the next day Saturday, not on Sunday, and she stayed till late Sunday evening, if my memory serves me correctly. And she was really tired as a result Monday morning. And therefore, she's bouncing back, but she needs some rest. So we have to bear those things in mind. And I hope that Mr. Armstrong's own experience will be of help to you. There's a time when we do expect that Mr. Armstrong won't be doing the things that he has done to the same extent, or maybe that others will play a role. I think that it would be a mistake to anticipate the future in terms of interpreting his role as one of the two witnesses. If that's God's decision, that's God's decision. If not, it's not. They're going to come anyway, and the work has to be done no matter what. It's very likely that in terms of Paul's letter to the Thessalonians about falling away in a mystery of iniquity, that there would be someone taken out of the way, someone who is no longer able to restrain. We have as many individuals with erroneous ideas circulating in the work as we have had those who left. And I'm just warning you, because that can happen. I probably will address the question this afternoon with respect to the holy days themselves, and I would only say at this point, if you think that this is the truth of God and that we are here because God commanded us to be here, on this day, then I ask you, whatever happened to the church, such that the Church of God Seventh Day, out of which this work began, doesn't do these things? When did they, and when did the ancestors in the Church of God, depart from the customs of the New Testament church, which we say we keep, and come to the place where they didn't keep these things? And if it happened once before that people get away, if you please, from holy days, from tithing, from Sabbath, from even a knowledge of what man is, a knowledge of the world tomorrow, then it could happen again as it happened before, over and over and over and over again. The reason we have churches in Revelation 2 and 3 described is not that we all should take note in terms of ourselves alone, in terms of the congregations alone at any time, but the fact that history shows there are ups and downs, and things are restored and things are neglected. It would appear that the Sabbath was practically forgotten near the turn of the second millennium, that is around 1000 AD. There's not the slightest indication that initially Peter Waldo even understood the Sabbath when he was beginning to be called, because he was called out of the Roman Catholic Church. And only later did the presence of the Sabbath among Waldensians, and not all Waldensians were the Church of God, make itself manifest. The Church of God, Seventh Day in the United States, basically never kept the holy days. Some individuals within it did, and scattered individuals not even associated did. The Church of God in Mexico kept them until the middle of the 1950s, with remnants of ministers who must have gone to Latin America kept them, and some even in significantly Jewish manner, because perhaps they had no tradition to distinguish what we should do as distinct from some of the customs of the law that were in fact typical of the Levitical priesthood. But I would only warn you that, and as we were saying last night, you need to be aware of your state of conversion. You need to be aware, for that matter, of why the devil is turned loose at the end of the millennium to test those at the end as distinct from all those in the middle and near the beginning. Because we do tend to get in a state of mind where we take things for granted. And God has to know where we stand. On this basis, Mr. Armstrong's role is less significant and will continue to be under the present set of circumstances. And when that happens, there are always those who choose to do their own thing more and more. Hence, despite what has been said, there are more and more younger women who choose to have abortions. In the Church of God, we had a tragic case where indeed the woman kept the knowledge of such an operation from Mr. Joseph DeCotch and myself, where we were responsible in a sense for her, because we were taking care of her. She was on third tithe. And we barely got her to the abortion clinic where the operation had been performed in order for them to do something about her sudden decline in health, because she had an infection. And that was something that they were responsible for. She was able to walk to the car. We had to carry her out of the car. That's the first time I've ever been in an abortion clinic. It's made to look like paradise, but it resembles hell. It's locked from the inside. And they're telling you what people are doing. The doctor, was already leaving, thinking maybe we weren't there, and we would have had to knock, and the nurse came and opened the wound, they opened the hospital. And you suddenly look and hear these lovely green flowers on green lattice work painted on the walls, and the blue sky, and it was all psychologically oriented for murder, which is what it is. It's the intent of murder. This girl had been playing around with a married man. They call it more than physical involvement, which too many use today as a pseudonym for porneia or fornication. She was raped twice because she cultivates friends of that sort. This is a fringer, a baptized individual for 2 years in the Church of God. That's only a part of the story. The rest of it is not even as pleasant. After she was in that hospital, they decided she had to go in a real one. And the doctor saved her within 1 hour of death. That is, her infection was going, taking her down and down and down. And they were filling her with more and more drugs. And they finally knew they had about an hour to go when they had given her enough drugs to counter the infection. And she was within an hour of death for her foolishness. And after all of this, she decides to leave the church. I just warn you, that's the moral side. Then there's the doctrinal side, the side of deception in teaching, the side of bad example. And these things do creep up more and more as Mr. Armstrong's traditional role of example and disciplinarian ceases. Today, I would like to discuss a topic that I have presented on other occasions, and in a sense it is not unfitting for the Feast of Trumpets. The question we often ask today is, what does this festival mean? Why are we here? And of course, the issue is that it pictures the time of the intervention of God and the reestablishment of the government of God on earth. But I would like to pose and perhaps open an area of study that will be of help for a relatively learned, educational, and competent group such as you are, is how long has the government of God been removed over the earth? I'm not talking about in the church. Because if we get a picture of when it is restored, we really ought also to have a picture of when it was removed. And what is the character of the world since its removal? What shall be the character of the world upon its restoration? And we will discover some things in the Bible and in related areas in the sciences that should prove rather obvious on the one hand, yet surprising on the other. First, we draw to our attention a verse in John's account of the Gospel, chapter 12, verse 31. Jesus is speaking here of a time when the prince of this world, because he is ruling this world, and he's speaking here of the devil, or Satan, the adversary, who is a spirit being, is in fact going to be cast out because Jesus himself qualified to replace him. The action was sufficient that Jesus could say, now shall the prince of this world be cast out. On the other hand, the actual fulfillment or performance doesn't take place till finally the Day of Atonement, which follows the return of Christ, symbolized by the Feast of Trumpets. But all the cause and the qualification of the one to replace him, everything was then settled. Christ was without sin. He had, in fact, subdued the devil in his reasoning. He did not yield to temptation. And so there was no question that Jesus qualified to replace Satan. Now, interestingly, we learn here that Satan is the prince of this world. He's also elsewhere the god of this world, but he's not the king. And I would like to point out, Jesus recognized that the one who is ultimately the supreme ruler over all, and under whom every sin that exists is allowed, and who has the responsibility for allowing it, is God, who is king. And he has allowed this spirit to do what he has done. And this spirit is in the role of a prince. The implication is that there is someone higher. There the king over all the universe and the angels. The question is, on earth, does the prince do the will of the king? He ought to. He has not. So the question now will be, what is the nature of the government of this prince who has rebelled against the king of the universe, the king of this earth, and who has, in fact, had charge of it totally because he was given charge of it and has abused that responsibility? We shall now also look in John's account of the gospel, and you will be surprised, on the one hand, how often the verses at this moment I will choose all come from the writings of John, not Matthew, Mark, or Luke, because John is addressing a question in his own mind. John's is the only account of the gospel which parallels Genesis. Matthew does not, Mark does not, Luke does not. John goes back in the beginning, that's the word. And therefore, John had an awareness of the question today in terms of writing that the others were not. They had other reasons for writing Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Chapter 8, if you please. Jesus had asked them, "Why do you not understand my speech?" Verse 43. "It's because you cannot hear my word." Now, you should understand what Jesus is saying. Let us see now in verse 44. Jesus said, "You are of your father the devil. The lusts of your father you will do." Lust or covetousness, it's the same thing. Now, I would like to define, some of you of German background, of course, know that in German we use this very word, lust, to refer to legal desire as well as illegal desire or lust. Whereas in English we use a separate term so that desire is neutral or satisfying, and we have to qualify by the word evil to make it erroneous, but lust is a word in itself that means something which is erroneous, something wrong, something illicit. So it appears that a character of this one who is a devil, that is one who is an adversary, an evil motive, personality in the spirit world, has certain desires that are evil. Now, he is not carried away by these in the sense that human beings can be. If we don't have the Spirit of God governing us, we merely yield to the desires. We get hungry and we're likely to eat clean meats as well as unclean. Or we're likely to take somebody's property or our own for a use. We have to be governed by the law of God. The spirits had the knowledge of the law of God, but they decided that they wanted, that's covetousness, certain things that were not theirs. And the one thing that they wanted was the power to decide right from wrong, which was God's. It was not long ago that I had the chance to meet a man in whom was a spirit. And this spirit came to me and he asked a simple question. He said, "I want to know how to change God's mind." You know, we have individuals who come to the campus of all sorts. And Jesus didn't cast out every spirit, and there was no relative wanting this person changed. And I have no reason to follow other than Jesus' example, who didn't always act, because we weren't dealing with the problem. I'm dealing, I know, with what. He told me, and I explained to him, of course, what you have to do, that we human beings, you know, we must repent. And then it is not that God changes his mind towards sin. He changes his mind toward us because he places the penalty on Jesus. But we have to be willing to repent. We have to be willing then to do what God's law is. What he wanted to do is how to change God's mind so that he could get into God's presence again, without changing his character, so that God would do what he wanted done. He knows that God's personality is such that he'd like to be in God's presence. As he said, "I've seen God eyeball to eyeball." Now, I haven't, and I presume none of you have. I would like to meet you if you have. and deal with the problem. He also explained the rest of his character. He said, I have said things to the Almighty that no man has ever said. And that's probably true. And that's one reason he's no longer in God's presence. But he would like God to change his mind so that he can do his own thing and get God to do what he's doing. And we discussed philosophy a little bit. He believes in competition. And that's exactly the devil's world. That competition means that the best man wins and the other man loses. This kind of competition for jobs, for rank, for office, for some other person, or to get control of money or property. Instead of loving our neighbor and doing good and being concerned for the other, appointing it according to one's natural ability, he would use the basis of drives in order to seize power. So the first thing we know, the lusts of your father. So there are characteristic lusts here in the sense of covetousness, asking for responsibility that is not one's own. The devil isn't tempted by a human lust. He isn't tempted by smell for flowers, that kind of thing. We're dealing here with the realm of spirit. He wanted the authority that God had. He wanted ultimately to become God, and he certainly is the God of this world. Now, he was a murderer. That means that he had the spirit of murder. That's the nature that he allowed to enter in. Now, in Ezekiel 28, which many of you have turned to many times, we learn that Satan was once a cherub and that he sinned, that he was, in fact, perfect in his way. That's in his conduct. But he had the capacity to make decisions one way or another. The way, perfect in his way, that's an action. The way you live, the way you think, the way you talk. He was perfect in that until iniquity was found in him. So he had the capacity. Perfection does not limit your capacity to make decisions. Well, let's get that straight. That's where everybody makes a mistake who asks the question, how could it be? Perfection is not a question of no capacity to make a decision. You can be perfect and still have the capacity to make a decision. The power to make a decision is a part of, let's say, total perfection. God doesn't sin, but he doesn't sin because he has willed not to. It doesn't express the kind of character he wants to be and that he is. Satan became such because when he was the cherub, Heliel, the light bringer, the Latin calls it Lucifer, he was impressed by what he saw in himself. Let me explain something. This spirit that I talked to said, and you will pardon his expressions, he said, I asked him, you know, what was it like long ago? He said, when I was a child, they said, that's so long ago you can't comprehend. That's true. When I was a child, he said, God blew our minds. He told us we were going to have the opportunity to rule the universe. He said there was only one problem. We were told how, but we had no way to compare, he said. We had no way to compare whether God's way was the way it ought to be run or some other way. We knew he had said, this is harmony, this is perfection, this is love, this is mercy, this is justice, this is righteousness. Defining all that, drawing attention that his relationship to the angels produced
joy,
happiness, harmony,
love,
all the good things when they were in the presence of God at his throne in heaven. But now that the angels were given charge over the earth to start with as a test, it occurred to them, as it would have occurred to you, why don't we try something else? And one-third were ultimately persuaded to try their own thing. And apparently, the devil was the one responsible. That is, that particular being started it. Hence, he's the one to whom the finger of God is directly pointed. They decided that God might not know everything. Well, this is exactly the problem today. This is why God allows sin in this world for human beings, because God knows that human beings would never agree to go by his law voluntarily until they had examined every other aspect. That's the way human beings are. Young people today sample drugs. They sample marijuana. They also sample what an older generation did, tobacco, and all sorts of alcohol. They sample sex, and the new theme, too often in the Church of God, is called a physical involvement. We want to sample that. We maybe don't want to go, quote, all the way, unquote. Or as one girl said, well, I'm still partly a virgin. We want to test all these things. We don't want to do what the church has said or what God has said or what the minister has said or what parent has said or what teacher has said or older brother or older sister when it conforms to the Bible. We would like to try something else, and then if that's right, we'll get back to it. And in the meantime, there's damage and you pay the penalty whether you like to or not. And God, knowing this, has allowed the human family to live in this world. We are given the privilege of coming out of it early, the privilege of seeing what other people are doing, so that we don't make the same mistake. God says that you should test his law. You test the question, thou shalt not commit adultery. You don't test it by committing adultery. That brings the penalty. You test it by not committing adultery. Then you discover when you don't commit adultery what happens. Then you look at those who do and who've made the decision to do it, and then see the difference. You don't start to sin to prove whether God is right. You start to obey. Now the angel, initially, were persuaded step by step, first by one, then maybe by another with different arguments, and ultimately a third over an incalculable period of time, which we shall look at later, followed the leader. And the premise, the philosophy, is clear. They were not going to let God decide alone what should be done. They were going to experiment and find some other way that they thought might make better sense, because they then could be in a position of deciding right from wrong, as God was in a position. And hence, the first sin here mentioned is the sin of covetousness, false desire, translated lust in my King James Version, seeking what was not their responsibility. Now it says, along with that, he entertained an attitude of competition. He didn't see why God should always be God. He thought it might be just as well that he could become one too and make these top-level decisions and do it his way. So he became, as a result, a murderer. Now I want you to notice when. It says he was a murderer from the beginning. Well, we'll look at that and see what the beginning is. First of all, there was something before the beginning that is recorded in Ezekiel 28. This being was perfect in his ways until iniquity was found in him. He was perfect until the beginning, because he was a murderer from the beginning, when he was given charge over the world. In the beginning now, we read in terms of Genesis chapter 1, that God created the heavens and the earth. And in that same beginning, said John, for the Word was there as well as the Father. So there isn't any question that the time of this sin from Genesis 1:1 pertains to the creation of the world after the angels had spent an undefined time in the presence of God in heaven and had understood now what they were called upon to do. He abode not in the truth, which implies that he once did. He abode in the truth once, and then he abode not. But he didn't stay with it. So he had the truth, and finally when he departed from it, it's because now he's different. There is no truth in him. When he speaks, a lie, he speaks of his own, because he is a liar. And he's the father of it. So he covets. He's a murderer. He's a liar. These are characteristics of the government of the devil. 1 John 3:8 is now interesting in this connection, telling the same story from a legal point of view. He who commits sin is of the devil. So he's apparently the one who started it all. For the devil sins from the beginning. Not from long after the beginning, just before Adam. See, the premise has been that the devil sinned when he decided to ascend above the clouds, Isaiah 14, and challenge God on his throne. But all the rest of the time, the world under the angels had been under the government of God. That's, I think, the false conception we have had. But in some way, the devil really didn't sin till near the end of the world over which he was responsible. He ascended to heaven. That was the sin. He was cast down. And then God recreates the world in creation week, the rest of Genesis 1. This is not the case. That was the climax, the final angry moment when they decided to challenge God once and for all, and they lost. But in the meantime, they had been sinning, the devil and his angels, and the devil's sin is from the beginning. For this purpose, the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil, whether in human beings or the government of the devil over the earth, influencing nations and peoples, religious, social, economic, political leaders, and any other aspects in terms of media. If we want to know what the government of the devil is like, we really could look into geology and have an answer. But we really need to understand what we're looking for, because it is not always clear how to distinguish in this world and in our thinking the works of the devil from the works of God, because the devil is using nature. It's a natural world in which we live. And in this natural world, the devil's government is manifest. But how do we distinguish that government from the government of God in the physical creation over which the angels were put in charge? What we need to know then is, what is the nature of the government of God in terms of the natural world? What is the nature then of the devil should be in opposition? Let's turn for a moment to a verse in the book of Hebrews that makes it clear that the angels as a whole were responsible for another age. For unto the angels has he not put in subjection, Hebrews 2:5, the world to come whereof we speak. The implication being that he has put in subjection to angels something previous to the world to come. The world to come of which we speak in terms of the good news of the kingdom of God and the new heavens and the new earth, those lie in the future, the millennium. What happens prior to God's intervention through Jesus Christ at the beginning of the millennium then is characterized by a world in which angels have subjected the world. Now, there's certain things since man was on the earth that man is responsible for, so that angels do not normally manifest themselves and change things. That is, the physical laws are to be left intact, and this is why we can have the sciences, chemistry, mathematics, and physics. Those things are intact. The angels do not alter them. There are people who can contact spirits and interfere in nature, and we get in the realm not of science, but of parapsychology, things that cannot be tested with the means of science, that can only be described. Prior to man, the world was wholly in subjection to angels. Well, first we're going to examine a number of scriptures which tell us the nature of the world under God. Then we're going to look at the world as it is and see what the difference is. Let's turn to the book of Isaiah, with which we are familiar, chapter 11. Here is the story of the government of Christ ultimately being established. Now, in this account, you will notice that there are different aspects of the government. It involves a number of things in verse 2. It involves wisdom and understanding and counsel and might and knowledge and judgment and correction in verse 3. Helping the poor, reproving with equity the meek who need reproof, smiting the earth with a rod of his mouth, that is, speaking when things need to be corrected with force, slaying the wicked with his words, and if need be with commands to have them perish and not upset the world. Now, beside all this, we come to the character of nature. So we have the character of thought and action in terms of the human mind, defined in verses 2 and 3 and 4. But what about the nature around us from which we derive a living? Here is a world, now listen carefully, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb. What a stupid wolf. The leopard shall lie down with the kid. Such insanity. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together. And a little child shall lead them. Can you imagine that? Oh yes, I presume you can, but have you really? There has to be a change of nature. Well, I wouldn't want to trust a little child leading a wolf, a leopard, as well as a lamb and a calf and a lion. The cow, well, whenever you want to check the nature, obviously action changes in terms of dietary need. The cow and the bear shall feed. Their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. Now we're getting an interesting picture, totally different from what anybody on the farm or any city boy at the museum would believe possible. The suckling child shall play at the hole of the asp, the poisonous snake. The weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. The implication, not being bitten. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, or government. Mountain is a symbol. And at this time, of course, the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as waters cover the sea. Now, imagine a world, if you can, in which all the animals of Africa that are clean to eat are never hunted by a leopard or a lion, but continue to multiply at their present rate. and you will have a world as insane as ever was imagined. We must draw the conclusion from this. There is not only a change in instinct, that is, in the programming of the brain of the animal world, in which animals do not devour each other, but in which the rate of multiplication also must be different, and therefore there is a genetic variation in the rate of reproduction that must be altered. For a lion to as straw as the ox, we would have to presume logically there is a difference in the digestive system. An ox, you know, these animals have more than one stomach. Of course, there could be a lion like a horse in terms of eating straw with a different type. It isn't saying the lion becomes a clean animal any more than the horse is clean, the cow is clean. There has to be a change in reproduction. There has to be a change in digestion. There has to be... Well, it is different. Our world today is called one governed by the balance in nature. Each thing devours the other, the spider, the fly, the big fish, the little fish, the predatory animals, the non-predatory animals, the frog, the insect. Everything feeds on the other thing. That's the world in which we live. That's not the world that shall be. I think we've been reared to assume that the no, the negative, is the only method of command. A much more successful, many more are successful when we set an example, when we lay out a program, and when children can participate. Now, the case of Abraham offering Isaac, of course, is an extreme. But it is, as laid out in Josephus, the Jewish historian of the first century, the present era, an account of a young man who was 25 when his father offered him, which implies that Isaac was in subjection to his father, was also uniquely cooperative in contrast to the way most parents and children relate. And that he would keep the way of the Lord, so the emphasis, obviously, was that Abraham was concerned about the most fundamental things as the way people ought to live, and to be concerned with justice and judgment. Well, God could have said any number of other things, but I think it's quite important to teach children to be just and fair, to teach them to have judgment, to make sound decisions. That the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him, or that God would bring upon you that which is spoken concerning you, that you should be able to rule 1, 2, 5, or 10 cities, or nations, and other great responsibilities. So the implication of verse 19 of chapter 18 is far broader than an initial reading might indicate. It emphasizes what is important in childbearing. The way of God, as laid out in the scripture, the sense of justice and judgment. I doubt that most parents are that concerned with a sense of fairness and of good judgment in their children. Yet this is fundamental in terms of the ability of children to get along and to be successes. There are a number of cases of the scripture that you're familiar with. I'm going to start with those that we sometimes overlook. In Ephesians chapter 4, where we have advice to parents, in this case fathers in particular, mothers not excluded. In Ephesians 6:4 it says, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath or anger. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." The meaning is obvious, that most parents, instead of dwelling on what we see in the last part of the verse, the nurture and admonition, that is the guidance, the concern, or the day-by-day interest, are likely to express themselves in the provocation of children to anger by an emphasis on discipline without the rest of the verse being considered. And so the first concern that Paul gives here, after he tells children in verse 1 of this same chapter to obey their parents in the Lord, because that is right, and to honor parents, the next
step is that parents should not provoke their children to anger by the kind of discipline that is sometimes administered, the kind of restriction that is sometimes not wise. The same thing is repeated in Colossians 3:21, in case you wanted to know whether this is emphasized in the Bible. On these two occasions, we note the same individual matter. Fathers, provoke not your children, lest they be discouraged. Some children become discouraged, some become angry, and some leave home. Now, the kind of instruction we have here to parents is the opposite of what most of us have given consideration to. We've considered child rearing as equivalent to child beating in some cases, it seems, and most certainly discipline, instead of the concern to know how to discipline so that children are properly instructed without wanting to leave home. This is a very important factor. There are many proverbs that you're familiar with. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. Instruction and correction, of course, removes that. Proverbs 22:18. Proverbs 22:6 tells you to train up a child. That's your responsibility. When that child is old, he will not depart from the way that you have trained him. Timothy was a responsible young man. What he had learned was the scriptures from a child. 2 Timothy 3:15. Well, you know that, of course, but you seldom realize that you ought to teach your children more about the Bible than you do. The Bible is full of examples in terms of moral responsibility. The Bible is a textbook on child rearing, far more broadly speaking than we are aware of. In 2 Samuel 13, verses 1 to 18, is a very elaborate illustration of what happens when young people, even within the relationship of cousins or half-brother and half-sister, get involved sexually, and the parent hasn't, as David failed to, instruct the children. And it explodes into the parent's face and into those that are involved. And there are many similar chapters all through the Bible that give both the direct instruction as to what is good, what is bad, how to make decisions, and many examples that illustrate consequences. What we should like to look at today is perhaps another approach to the subject. Mr. Boyce mentioned that in all probability, what would be said today for those who have the greatest problem would end up as words and not in performance. And being aware of this problem, aware of the fact that most of you who don't need it will get the most out of it, and those of you who need it most will get the least out of it. Well, that's why you need it most, because you have been getting the least out of it. And we're going to try to illustrate as much as we can how you directly cope with the problem. Now, the biggest mistake that we first make is to assume that a family problem or a parent-child problem is the other family's problem. We are here as a group. We are a church, and not merely am I addressing a series of statements to people who pay to come here, and each family as an individual comes here and goes and doesn't know his neighbor. We are dealing here with people who, in most instances, know dozens of other people. And one of the important parts of the function of the church is to admonish and to help one another, not to berate and not to gossip, but to figure out how to solve another's problem. We are told in the scripture that we should bear another's burden. We should also bear our own. And I think we need to take note of that. Let's take verses 1 on in chapter 6 of Galatians. Brethren, let me transfer it in terms of our present concern. If a parent is overtaken in a fault, and that's where most of the problems are, see. Not the children, but the parents. The parents are overtaken in the fault because they don't know how to rear the child. You which are spiritually sound as parents, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest as a parent you also be tempted to neglect your responsibility. The principle is the same. And you can read these words into it because that's what the problem is. It is a problem in which the parent has the biggest fault whenever there is a failure in parenting or child rearing. We're asked to bear one another's burdens. This is not speaking strictly of alcoholism or tobacco or drugs. It can involve ourselves in any number of things, financial and most certainly in child rearing, because in so doing you fulfill the law of Christ, which is love and concern for your neighbor. If anyone thinks himself to be something as a parent, let him take heed, because he may in fact be nothing. But sometimes parents who train children are in fact those who fall into this category. They don't listen. They think they know everything, and they're making some of the biggest mistakes. If you think you are something as a parent, when in fact you are nothing, you deceive yourself. Let every one then prove his own works. You need to examine whether you have been successful in how your children are reared. There are always those parents who overlook the faults of their children in the sense they don't face up to them, not in the sense of forgiveness, but in the sense they don't face up to them because in so doing they think it reflects on them, therefore they don't want to think about it. Each of you needs to prove your own. Well, then you have this kind of rejoicing. You can be happy in yourself. That is very important. And as well, every man should bear his own burden and every woman her own burden in child rearing and not dump it on others, especially babysitters. Sometimes these verses in the Bible are read as if they refer to anything but what is the problem. We're not told what the problem is or what the fault is, but I can tell you the faults can be varied and many, and one of the biggest is that of child rearing. And it is a test of your character in terms of your ability in governing in the world tomorrow. You're being tested today in your ability to command. How can you command a city when you cannot even command your family? There are many aspects or areas of child rearing. I certainly will just comment at random as one thought and another might come to our attention. First of all, we have mentioned the responsibility of child rearing in terms of church and Bible. There is the responsibility of child rearing in terms of school and education, probably the next most critical institutional relationship. Above all is the relationship of parent to child in the home. How is a child reared in the home? I think it is reflected by the fact that parents often must, or used to, or still must, but don't, spank their children in church, because they didn't know how to discipline or set an example when the children were home. Fathers should be aware of the children's needs for sports and an awareness, let's say, of job needs as the child, especially the boy, grows up. Mothers should be far more concerned about cooking, nutrition than most mothers are. And of course, there's always the opportunity in a lovely area, such as most of you live, in gardening and improving the home outside, but also involves a financial sense of work. The importance of knowing how children should choose friends and how and where they should play with those friends. And especially to be able to anticipate in advance the child's interests and needs. His social welfare, his understanding of culture and music, his ability to choose of the opposite sex the kind of friends from which later he might become acquainted with one, or she might become acquainted with one assume with whom a marriage might be made. We often make mistakes along the way that ultimately pave the way for mistakes in a future marriage when children mature. I have some experiences, many of you have experiences, and what I would like to suggest is that since I am asked to address this question, I will necessarily choose some experiences that occur to me as worthwhile in my estimation to present to you. This would mean also that you should consider some experiences worthwhile in your life to share with others. And then that you become aware, as Paul said in Galatians, that I read you verses 1 to 5 of chapter 6, of our responsibility mutually in this large congregation that today, and as you divide up for regular Sabbath services, your responsibility as parents in the local group or in your neighborhood. I'm sure that some of you know that there are parents in this church who are not living up to their responsibility. If they continue, will create greater and greater problems in terms of children. Yet you probably have never gone to those people. You have never been able to chat with the parents in private, or you've never had your children help those children. You have merely sat by while the problem degenerates. I think it is time we realize the important role to be played by the interplay of the church as an institution and the home, as well as the effect that the Sabbath school can have on young people for those who attend, and of course your interplay with the school system, your awareness of the faculty and teachers and the friends who are outside the church as well as those who are within. It is my intent today to help you in what I might call total awareness. That is a real grasp continually, every hour, at all times, of the various problems and opportunities that come your way. I will start with a few things. The importance is not in the order, because I would like to be free to cite the thoughts as they come to me. One of the things that I notice as characteristic in a school is that teachers of English correct one's English. The teachers of geography do not correct one's English. You know how this generally is. May not be true in every school, not be true with every faculty member. A paper written in a science class is tested for science, not English. And this problem that exists in the school, in which faculty members very commonly neglect everything but what's on their mind specifically, is characteristic of parents. That is, most parents never think to guide and instruct their children in good English usage. We speak English. We do not guide them and instruct them in good English usage until the child embarrasses the parent. And then there is either a collective explosion, or else nothing is done, and you have certain feelings about being embarrassed by your children. It is tragic, but it is true that this is most often the case. I have a rule in our home. It's not anything that's written on the wall, but it's just a logical thing. I expect children who are 1, 2, 3, and 4, who are learning to speak, to learn at the basic level at which they function. And I try to explain when mistakes occur in childhood and as we move up in age, what good usage and what better usage is. And above all, try to explain when I hear anything, any grammatical error occurs. That is the common problem with pronouns, I guess, is the most difficult. You know, the I and the me and the him and the he. Not necessarily, I'm addressing a problem that was maybe yours and you never resolved when you were growing up. But most of you speak English reasonably well. And therefore, as far as you know, God only judges you as far as you know. He's not judging you on the basis of what an English teacher knows. But it is a responsibility to see that your children speak correctly. Now, how you do it is important. You want to encourage them to face up to how they made the mistake. In other words, you commonly say, John and I. Let's use an illustration. Well, he saw John and me. He saw me. That's clear. Or Jane, and then they will use the wrong pronoun. I'm starting out with something simple. I'm trying to illustrate a point. Your success later in a job as a fellow or a girl heavily depends upon your ability to speak well, to speak clearly, and to speak accurately. I think that you test yourselves in many other moral areas by whether in an area such as this you're willing even to give concern to a problem. And that's why I wanted to start out with something that isn't moral. Because if we tend to be lax and not totally aware that the spelling is correct, whether the favorite aunt or uncle knows how to spell or not, you're instructing your child, you're not instructing the uncle. It might even bring you an inheritance. Nevertheless, it is important to be aware. I think most parents let children do what they want to if they write postcards and letters to start with. My mother always went over every letter that I ever wrote when I was little until I could learn to write properly and correctly. And I can remember that many of them were filled with little erasures because I didn't know how to spell some words. Didn't know how to punctuate. I even had to learn in school that in America, I is so important, we capitalize it. Because I just spell a little I with a dot, like you have a little A. But when it comes to I, this seems to be significant in the English language, that I is very important. Well, don't get me wrong, I is bad grammar. I'm using just the word I is very important. All right, some of you are awake. You want to take note? And this is a simple little thing, but it is an expression of total awareness. You will discover that your children will have far fewer problems later in reading. They will have far fewer problems in writing and expressing themselves. If you make them conscious now, when I find a paper that comes home from school, I read whatever I can get my hands on from the children, and when I find a mistake that is not corrected, I don't care if the paper has already been graded 1 or 2 months ago or 1 or 2 years. If I discover something I haven't seen, I want to find out whether the children have corrected the problem that then was. Yeah, you'll find old school papers around in the drawer. If you make this a habit, you will see that your children learn it as a habit, and it isn't something that will become a stress factor for them. It will become natural, like eating. And most of you are not stressed by that. It's still too much. But this makes it easy. You don't have to become eccentric, and you need to realize that a child has to learn how to solve these problems. The child should have access to a dictionary. First, you don't ask your little child at age 5 to use a dictionary. You are the dictionary. But later, you should acquire a dictionary of appropriate age level. And many of them, most of them for that age, are worth getting only at the used bookshops and turning them over again, because you don't want to keep those until you get the more elaborate ones that are of collegiate worth. I would be surprised how many of young people here today would say that they had never had a dictionary that they could call their own, that they could use as they were going through primary grades. This is a very important little investment. I can get a pocket dictionary that will solve most of my needs, probably for no more than a dime of Salvation Army. I don't have to go to the leading new bookshop for a hardcover item, something that I can put in my pocket. And that's what a child should have. This is the kind of way that a parent should become aware of the needs of a child, not after the problem is so serious that you're so frustrated that you decide a dictionary is necessary, but that you anticipate the child's needs by providing at the appropriate age level a dictionary. Something that is also legible, but that isn't too brown. You know, these old dictionaries can have brown paper. You want it something that is reasonably attractive for the time. Those are little factors to bear in mind. The child has problem in adding and subtracting. Well, we're dealing with the simple things in math. I doubt that most parents are very concerned when children come home with school papers in the arithmetic area. And when mistakes are made, I doubt that most parents will ever check to see that the child has corrected them. Now, I'm not asking a mother who's had little training to try to resolve all the intricacies of the new mathematics. But I am saying it is important that every parent should do as much as he can and in this area and be sure that the children learn from the first grade on. Whenever there is a problem unresolved or incorrect and hasn't been corrected, that the child learns to correct it. I've always told students I would rather have a student make a mistake and correct it later than accidentally get it right and not know why. I think that should be clear to everyone. You know, sometimes you get it accidentally right. It is very important that when you make a mistake, I don't care in what area it is, you go back to correct it. That's a good habit. And parents should see that it is done. Now, if you happen to know of a family with a large number of children and where the opportunity to provide personal small dictionaries is unlikely because of financial pressure, here is an area in which you can do something for someone else as a group. And I think that we need to bear in mind how others can help those where handicaps are. When I hear a neighbor child say something, or any child of any of our friends, assuming that I don't know the parents that well, and I hear a mistake that is spoken grammatically, I try to repeat a thought. It would seem appropriate in which I use a similar expression and state it correctly. That's what we call total awareness. Yet I think most parents are not concerned. If you find children here were reared in homes where ain't is commonplace but incorrect, as it is in middle America, then what you ought to do is try to phrase a sentence where that isn't used until the child hears something else. I grew up in a home in which my father learned English only after he started the primary grades. And he only had into the sixth year of schooling before he had to make a living for my grandfather, who did not know English in those early days. Well, my grandfather was a math teacher in a university in Europe, and they didn't need German-speaking math teachers over here in that day. So my father didn't have good grammar as I would have wished. Sometimes I repeated his mistakes. My mother was very careful never to correct me in his presence, but always to correct me some other time. That's total awareness. The proper relationship between husband and wife. And she explained that my father had only 6 years of education. She had 12 different opportunities. Therefore, there were things that she understood. And it wasn't hard for me to realize it because the teacher agreed with my mother, see? Well, these things are important, and it reflects itself in many other areas of life. If this is the constant approach, when I find these things happening, I always want to be sure that my wife does her part, because she sees more of the papers, and this is also of great interest to her, and she could tell many of you mothers what it's like to help children overcome some of these common mistakes that we make in the most fundamental, simple areas of life, which is the proper use of the native language we speak and the proper use of the simple math that we will all have to use even when we go grocery shopping and adding up our bills at the end of the month.
Now, there is a point at which parents turn over to the teacher's responsibility where we're not qualified. But if the right habit is set in these areas where every parent has a talent, because you had a training and you have natural ability to be a parent, because God gave this general ability to all normal human beings, if you have reared children to be aware of these things and to discipline themselves step by step, to read the kind of literature that is well written, doesn't have to be too elaborate, don't force children, but you want to force them to be correct as they proceed, and we don't all proceed at the same rate.
But we must
proceed correctly.
That's the responsibility.
When this is inculcated, then it isn't so difficult for parents to go on and deal with other children and other responsibilities in young people
to have this discipline in their own minds when they are in school. We had a little interesting occasion. You've heard the little boy who tells you, or the little girl who says, "I hate school." Heard that this morning.
Now, in this case, the parent immediately said, "Now, you really don't hate school. You like it."
I didn't say, "You don't hate school, do you?"
And the child will say, "Of course I do, you know."
You've got to anticipate how to get the child to realize that indeed the child likes school, which it did. And the boy admitted, "Of course, sure, I like school."
Told me that that's the one thing he likes to do when the new school year begins, is go to school.
That's the boy's family.
See, the father
perceived
the problem. He is conscious of total awareness.
I think that's a good example. I appreciated it very much.
Because, you know, a child that finally hates school
hates himself. That will be a very great tragedy.
And I think it's nice when children realize it's so easy to say the thing that
other children say,
only to realize, well, really, that wasn't so. I like it after all. Now, there's a time
at the end of the year,
you'll first like to get home.
We understand that. But we want to watch these attitudes toward our educational system. And that's very critical because we're dealing here with those critical years when we're not dealing, let's say in the later teens, with other problems.
In a home and in a church,
we're confronted with the need
of how to behave in a chair. Well, that seems a little simple, doesn't it? Well, how many of you have wrestled with your children and wrestled with yourself because you didn't know how to sit comfortably in a chair for about an hour? A simple request.
If you find that your child is constantly getting up,
constantly frustrated, on your lap, off your lap,
the place to train the child is not in church in the front row, but in the aisle. The place to train the child is on those social occasions when you have friends, after you've also trained the child at home, when you're just together as a family.
Some of this may be dietary. Children who are constantly eating the very things that give them irritable energy.
And this is a factor, of course, with our heavy doses of ice creams and desserts and candies and pop drinks. You need to learn how to behave yourself as an individual in a social situation. And you do this as parents by example. And your children, if you find yourself struggling with the problem here,
what you really ought to do is have your parents help you learn how to sit down quietly for a little while at home with others, maybe reading a bit or letting your mother read to you.
My mother used to read to us.
She read stories. I don't remember what they were.
They might have been these grim German fairy tales, for all I can say. But I was aware in having them read to me what good English sounded like. I wasn't conscious of what I was aware of, but inevitably it occurred. I think most parents let children read whatever they want to, and most of it is pulp literature.
It is important that every parent knows something of the books brought home from school,
something of the books required from any local library, something of the books that a child would like to acquire on his own. Some do not find any depth of interest in reading, but in some other areas.
Most of our children, we have four, our youngest child is the one who reads the most. The other three read less. And that's because there are other interests. But what is important is to provide books in advance. I do not do what my father did. Now, my father got me books that he was interested in. He wasn't totally aware. And I found Washington Irving's stories of his journeys to Spain a little over my head when I was in the fourth or fifth grade. But it did teach me a lesson. I want our children to have books at their age level, and my wife and I take our children to used bookshops, that's where they're cheaper, brethren, and we go over the books and show the children the books that are there. And when a child says, look, I like this book, it's interesting, fine, I'll hold it in my hand and I'll tell them to go look for something else, and I will discover they may have picked out three or four. When it's all over, only one is interesting, and the other three we put back. Most parents let children pick out what they read. It is very important that parents be alone to steer the child at first and to analyze what is the child's interest. Is your interest in boys' stories, adventure? Is your interest in girls' lives? Is your interest in, and then it can go up and up on the scale of age and experience. I think most parents turn this responsibility over to the children without any concern. When I find that our children pick out a book, I say, well, you know, it's a good book. So I ask them why they like it. It's a bad book. I ask them why they chose it. And I find that I point out certain things. Is that really what you want to read? And in reality, they find something in there. No, that's not what they wanted to read. A book goes back on the shelf in the store. You go to something else. But our children have just a few books, not many at all. I'm the one who has the books. Or ask my wife. The point is, we haven't overloaded them. We have left them to choose what their interests are. The youngest likes to read more than the others. But we have another one who is an artist in her interest. And so we have tried to provide what is most interesting and valuable to her. We try to provide the kind of photographs, the kind of artwork, the kind of pictures, the kind of picture books that illustrate in our mind the best quality and character in the presentation of any form of art. And then she asked for this or asked for that, and we try to select such. It is very important that young boys and girls, as they grow up, have an opportunity to develop in the areas of their greatest concerns. A girl, since I'm on that subject, should have far more experience and opportunity in cooking at home, the awareness of nutrition. We have encouraged our children to be aware of nutrition because at practically every meal we talk about, you know, whether the meal was really good, whether there was something wrong with the recipe. And I don't criticize my wife when the recipe went wrong. We all analyze these things. And the children are aware that my wife experiments with recipes, and some prove to be more successful, and the older she becomes, the more aware she is of a good recipe just visually without ever having to experiment again. And our children are probably as knowledgeable as any in this church area, or any church area, because I have another habit that most people don't. I get cookbooks from around the world or wherever I travel. So we eat South African, we eat Thai cooking, we eat Korean, we eat Middle Eastern, or we even eat Middle American. And the children are aware of this. And it is, in a sense, an interesting experience, because when we have brethren from Malaysia traveling through this country, as we have Chinese from Malaysia and Singapore, or we have Thai or a Southeast Asian, and sometimes a combination with Middle Eastern rice, and we have something special. And most recipes are successful. And our children find them interesting. Now, the cook at our house while we're gone is our youngest 13-year-old girl, and she's cooking for her 16-year-old brother. And so far, it is a success. But she has had the opportunity to see how things are done. She doesn't try to do what she can't. She's not forced to take responsibility before she is mature. She's given an opportunity to do simple things first. Boil water, what you young brides learn, and then fix eggs the way your husband wishes it. You know, or your father or your brother. Now, none of us like eggs just like the other. The only one who is an exception is myself. Any egg that no one else eats, I do. Too hard, too soft, you know, too young, too old, it's mine. That's the way it turns out. Nevertheless, our boy learned something of cooking, and we had a marvelous Labor Day weekend of 1/3 of the congregation for which I am responsible, and no small number of young men and older men assisted in cooking. I think this was very nice. We were in the Angeles National Forest, 5,000 feet up. You have nothing like that here. This is really a marvelous opportunity. You have a goat roast instead. But it is something in which young fellows can participate in as well, because too many young fellows become, bachelors away from home, going to school, getting a job, and they hate themselves because they don't know how to cook, and they want to either go somewhere where the environment isn't what it ought to be, or cooking isn't what it ought to be to solve the problem. I think that every father, every mother owes it to a child in child rearing to see that boys can learn to cook those things which are fundamental to survival, and then girls should go beyond that. Now, some fellows are really great at cooking, and of course the greatest chefs in the world are usually men. These things can happen without children intruding into the kitchen. I think it is very sad when a girl comes home, or a boy, and when mothers are not prepared, as every mother should be, to provide what the child needs. If you didn't have much for lunch at school, you want to have something ready when the child gets home. And it's nice to have the child participate in the work in the kitchen, setting the table, and letting the child have an opportunity to set the table in his or her own way. No, there are certain things you do from day to day. You can bring flowers sometimes, sometimes you don't. You bring different napkins sometimes. Just let these little things occur. The problem is that children, when they are little, like to do these things, and then often they are reaching that age in which, interestingly enough, parents sometimes don't want them to bother. They're doing it better, and the child can lose interest. You want to keep that interest up all the time. You want to give the opportunities all the time. We take our children, if we go shopping in a store, we may be going for something else altogether, maybe school clothes, and we happen to go in a department store. We'll take ourselves often through the area where glasses or dishes are to let children see what is there. Things we don't have, things we don't intend to buy, but it gives them an idea of what things there are, and we try to provide something simple at home. I think the worst thing to do is, of course, to provide nothing but plastic and paper plates. It's much nicer to provide something else. Now, you know, I'll just give you a little illustration of how to save money, because what I'm doing is getting a lot out of the dollar. The other day we went to a shop, a kind of thieves market, and there turned out to be a broken set of dishes. By broken, I don't mean the dishes were broken, but the set was broken. There were five of this, three of that, four of that, seven of something else. And since now there are sometimes two, at most four of us at home, two of the children are away, we decided that this broken set, which had at least four of all the things that were important, was worth it. And we bought the whole thing for $5. Not bad. But it's a way of saving money, and they were very nice, hand-painted pre-World War II Japanese ware. Very lovely. It meant something. When the children put it out on the table, when food is on them, it's different than with the other plates we've had. And we don't make any pretense it's a complete set, and we wouldn't use them for guests. But the children saw them. The children used them. It provides a little something different. And children get used to what you can do in the house, at home, and make it interesting. We have different kinds of tablecloth. the good and the indifferent. And sometimes we have none on some of our tables. Sometimes we use clothing that could be made out of shirts. You know, in our travels we found cloth made in Southeast Asia, sold, for instance, in Samoa. And this cloth comes in a long sheet. And it's been one of the most interesting things. Instead of the regular tablecloth, you know what we do? We unroll this sheet that could be made into a man's shirt. And it covers the whole table. And it's a design you've never seen before. And people think it's great. And the children put something different out from time to time. It's a matter of making life interesting without, you know, making it scary. And this is the way to keep children's interest up all the time. We have a garden outside. You usually have lawns. We happen to have the opportunity of other kinds of things that wouldn't survive here as well. But our children learn to plant. They learn to water. Our little girl sowed at age 14 a garden of popcorn. Now, this happens to be the red popcorn that few of you see, though some of you are more aware of it. It is the tenderest popcorn that I know and extremely tasty. It's doing quite well. That's her garden. We're going to collect the corn, we're going to save some seed, and we're going to have popcorn on Saturday night or Friday evening. And it will be something she did, not something we bought out of the market only. We don't all have the opportunity, but anybody who doesn't live in an apartment, someone who lives even in an area such as many of you know, where the voices are, there's a possibility to hack out of the part of your backyard a small garden. And of all things, this area grows okra, at least where the voices are. Now, we don't even have okra looking that well. But our children see flowers, they see plants, they see insects, they see birds, and they used to see goats. Totally out of the ordinary experience. We don't enslave them with spading. We don't enslave them with water. But they do learn there's a need. They follow mother and help mother, or they follow me and help me. We build a little fence if need be. We build a pen for the chickens. And the children find that a chicken is a very interesting company when it's little, especially those that are, you know, not fully normal. And there are chickens like that. We have one in particular that wants to peck at your feet and climb up on you and peck anywhere and everywhere. It's just not normal. That's all. We're going to keep it because it needs tender loving care, whether it produces anything or not. You know, these are interesting things that a child's life can be full of. I had a marvelous opportunity with my wife of visiting one of the farms here, and I saw some things grow that we don't ever grow, never grown soybeans before. We learned something about it. We try to do the same thing with our children as it is possible to do here on a farm, teaching children care of animals, teaching children care of stock,